This is Barry Tyker of the Oral History Project. Today is March 19th, 1998. I'm in the home of Professor Eugene Cameron, and we're continuing the discussion we started a few weeks ago. Let's begin today by talking about the environment within the Department of Geology itself. What brought you to Wisconsin? What kind of support you received from the department? Things of that nature.
When I came to the department, I was invited to join the department in 1947. I came to a department that was well recognized in geology and had produced a number of famous people in it. I recognized that they could provide the kind of support that one needed for a broad program in economic geology. Because in the course of a professional career, the economic geologist may be called upon to apply his knowledge of any branch of geology. And I assessed Wisconsin as being a place where that background could be provided because of the breadth and the quality of its faculty. And they had plans for expanding to meet the changing needs of the science, which took place over the World War II period. And I decided this was what I needed if I wanted a sound foundation for a program in economic geology. And at that point, I made the decision, with my wife's full support, to move from the U.S. Geological Survey in Washington to Wisconsin. And I've never regretted it.
When I interviewed Howard Temin, the noted oncologist, about his career at the University of Wisconsin, we talked about the research environment at the McArdle Lab, and he said that that was what kept him at Wisconsin. And a lot, he could have gone anywhere he wanted, of course. He said there was a research environment within the and a community of scholars there that allowed him to do the kind of work he wanted to and supported financially and intellectually. What about within the geology department? What kind of a camaraderie, what kind of a spirit?
You could regard the geology department as a family or a team, and their spirit was magnificent. I felt that this was the place where I would have full encouragement in developing my program, and they never let me down. So I would agree with Professor Timmons, is it?
Timmons, yes.
I would agree with him. That is a major reason that I have stayed with the University of Wisconsin. And I've never wanted to go back on that decision. They were a great bunch to work with, and my students benefited steadily from their help. Okay?
Yep. Last time we talked about, we have a three-legged stool here at the University of Wisconsin. It's called teaching, research, and service.
Yes.
And last time we talked about a very important leg of that stool, and that was research.
Mm-hmm.
Today we're going to talk a little bit about the teaching part of that three-legged stool.
Yes.
I know you were very serious about your classes. Mm-hmm. We talked last time about your book, At the Crossroads, and the fact that you taught that for how many years?
1947 to my retirement in January of 1981.
And were there any other courses that you taught frequently during your over the course of your career at the UW?
Well, let me say this. I carried what was regarded as a full teaching load throughout my years of activity on the faculty. It consisted of one undergraduate course in the spring. It was not my job to teach the main undergraduate courses, but I taught a course called Minerals of Public Problem, in which the purpose was to acquaint the students with the importance of minerals and why they were important, and why they should take an interest in the problems that they presented to us in maintaining our society and civilization. But over and above that, I had my courses in economic geology and ore microscopy, and I also had a course which I developed, and which I tried to give every year, but couldn't give every year, a spring field trip in which we picked an area of the United States and visited a series of mines which we had studied in advance. We had prepared a guidebook with the joint effort and of a seminar that preceded it, and we took our spring vacation, not going down and strutting around on the beaches in Florida. We were working and having a wonderful time.
Tell me a few of the places that you went.
We went to the coal deposits at Ottawa, Illinois. We went to the glass sand deposits at Ottawa, Illinois. We went to the fluorspar deposits of southern Illinois, the refractory clay deposits over in Missouri, the bauxite deposits in Tennessee, the clay deposits in western Kentucky and Tennessee, the talc deposits at Murphy, North Carolina, the copper deposits at Ducktown, Tennessee, the bauxite deposits in Arkansas, the barite deposits in Arkansas, and have I left anything out? Shouldn't have. No, that was, and we took a couple of trips up to the Canadian Shield and visited the great nickel and copper deposits of Sudbury. We visited Kidd Creek in western Ontario, the gold mines in the Naranda Ruin district over in eastern Ontario, and the deposits at Cobalt, Ontario, very famous deposits. Over the years, we covered quite a lot of ground, and we prepared a guidebook for each of those. It was an inch thick with maps and everything else. These students came in, and we weren't just on an excursion. This was a job for which this group had prepared itself by study and contribution. And they were wonderful.
These were basically graduate students?
Graduate students. Oh, we took one trip to Colorado, too, and Wyoming, and saw some of the things there. And we took about 10 to 12 days for the spring vacation and drove in a caravan. We made a caravan of cars. And I'll never forget those trips, and neither will my students.
Yeah.
And I carried a full teaching load in terms of research opportunities for students. During my tenure, I some 55 graduate students completed their master's degrees under my supervision, and 35 attained their PhDs. And they're all over the Canada, some in South America, some elsewhere, and I hear from at least half of them every Christmas. So I think my original aim when I came to the University of Wisconsin was a combination of teaching and research. And the only change I think that I would want to make, if I were doing it over again, to try to find more energy to do more of each of the things that I did.
I don't really have to ask you this, but I will anyway. I assume you enjoyed teaching a great deal.
Well, when I was awarded the Penrose Medal of the Society of Agronomic Geologists, the man who presented me said that I had a reputation as a good teacher. And I had a response for that. I told the audience, they say I've been a good teacher. Good students make good teachers. And I always had good students at the University of Wisconsin. That was in 1985 I spoke that. And I wouldn't change a word of that. It takes good teachers to make good students to make good teachers.
Has the level of students stayed pretty
much the same over the decades, or have there been periods? I know when you came here, you had the veterans, and they were just hungry as anything for education. Was everything along that level, or were there any time periods where things changed at all?
I can't detect any general changes. I had in my last years at Wisconsin, I had good students then, and no, I don't. That's not a question I'm going to answer.
Okay.
Because
what about the? Well, you mentioned last time you said that you had women in your program. Has the number of women in geology graduate school, did it increase or stay the same or decrease during your years as a professor?
It has changed. In the role of women in the program has changed in two ways. First, women have come onto our faculty. We have several at the present time. I won't go into detail. I don't think I can. And more women students have come into geology. The opportunities for women in geology in the 1940s and 50s were very limited. The opportunities as teachers were limited. That all changed in the 50s, in the 60s and the 70s particularly. And there we have an outstanding example is Professor Anderson, Mary Anderson, who has developed a first-class program in hydrology, just first-class. And we have others in there whose work I'm not so familiar. But as soon as it became apparent that there were really opportunities and they would be encouraged, the numbers of students and the numbers of faculty members began to increase and have continued to increase. Now, and it didn't come, in our case, it was only slightly a response to pressure from outside. It was a recognition, a gradual evolution of the role of women in society that brought things like geology to their attention and brought to the attention of the men, we'll say, that the programs need to be, I wouldn't say modified, but we should make it plain that they're open to women as well as men. And this did.
Was there any resistance on the part of any of the faculty toward that movement, or was it something that whose time had just come?
I can't recall any resistance. But when I first came to Wisconsin, in most branches, there weren't qualified women available.
Yeah.
Where would you get them? They weren't going into most of the graduate programs and or colleges around the country. There wasn't a supply. But there'd been no hesitation in the Department of Geology and Geophysics, of which I'm aware, to bring women onto the scene. And they've done well. Those that are able have done well.
Mm-hmm.
And I had some good women students before I retired. And I'm very glad to have them.
Mm-hmm.
And, okay, that's about it, I guess.
Okay. You gave a lot to your teaching. You always taught an undergraduate course. You had a full teaching load. We've talked about your research and the tremendous amount of research you did. The third leg of that stool at Wisconsin is service, and you weren't exactly a slouch in that category either. You you had a pretty full calendar. And I'd like to talk about some of the committee work that you were involved in throughout the course of your career at the university. And I guess we should probably start with the most high-profile one of them all, and that was your 3 years of service. Hold on a second. I'm turning this. Your 3 years of service on the university committee, and you served on the committee beginning in the 1966-67 academic year. you chaired the committee during the really, really crucial and rambunctious, I guess you could call it, 67-68 academic year, and you also served on the 68-69 university committee.
Well, there, the Dow chemical disturbances tended to make the university committee term stand out. But I regard several of the others very important.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we will talk about them as well.
Which do you want to talk about?
Let's start out with the university committee.
I'd rather start with the others.
Oh, okay. We'll work our way up.
That's where I got my background on the faculty. And they led to my appointment to election to the university committee. And there are two that I would name immediately.
Go ahead.
The divisional committees.
Mm-hmm.
Those serve a very important function in screening applications for permanent faculty. Now, the custom was to bring in a man, usually, unless he's very advanced, but many men were brought in at the assistant professor level.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, this was a time of trial to see whether they would fit in with the department
mm-hmm.
involved. In order to get them to associate professor level, the department would have to prepare a docket for them, telling their training, their careers, teaching experience, any research they may have been engaged in publishing, and so on, a full docket on their professional characteristics and also on personality, ability to get along with students, so far as it could be determined at that stage. Now that went to the dean, or no, it went to the divisional committee. In the case of geology and geophysics, it was the division of physical sciences. And that committee, consisting of representatives from various science departments, would then examine the docket and agree or approve or disapprove the transmittal of that docket to the dean for his approval. Or, let's see, I forget the exact mechanism, perhaps it's simply with the decision of the divisional committee. It went to the dean. The dean rarely turned down their recommendations. Now, this is a very important screening device. Tenure was not given lightly. It was given on the basis of solid information on the performance and character of the man. And it was a good system because it was preventive. No departmental chairman would bring such an application to the divisional committee unless he was pretty darn sure the man would qualify.
What was the, did most people generally get through the committee or?
Well, it did because it did. We didn't get their, get these applications unless the departments mm-hmm. were convinced that they were fully mm-hmm. qualified. You see, it was a shield,
mm-hmm.
a very important device. And in that committee, I began to learn the true nature of the University of Wisconsin and the important role that faculty
mm-hmm.
played during that period in the government of the university. The university at that time, remember, was the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Mm-hmm.
It was the Madison campus. That was the University of Wisconsin. Now, the second experience was my service of 7 years, I guess it was, on the University Research Committee, which was chaired by Dean Elvium. We met each year in a series of meetings, I should say a whole series of working weekends, in which we went over applications for Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation Fund in support of research by members of the faculty. Each member of the committee was assigned a department or group of departments and assigned the applications for research from that source.
Mm-hmm.
He would interview each of these people, discuss his research plans and so on, and ask for a justification of the funds requested, and report back to the committee. And the committee, usually by a unanimous vote, but sometimes just by a majority vote, would approve or disapprove and pass this on to the Alumni Research Foundation. Now, I was assigned for quite a while the engineering school. And that's how I got to know just about everybody in the engineering school. They're all busy as bees. And some awfully good research was going on there. But I did spend a year or two with the chemistry department and learned to know the people there. And more I began to realize the quality of the institution that I had joined, its breadth, and the people who were leaders in, particularly in science and engineering, in the development of these schools. And it gave me an insight into the workings of the university that I never would have had, as well as some awfully good friends.
Yes, right, to say nothing of that.
And it was out of that experience, I guess, that I was, and in fact, I had been chairman of a department for 5 years, that I was elected to the university committee finally.
Who elected you?
How was that election done? I forget the exact mechanism by which that was done. Somehow I got named as a candidate for it. Whether my department had a role in that, I don't know. You know, I can't answer that question.
I don't know for sure.
Out.
Oh, I can.
Cronin might be able to tell
Dave,
you.
Dave will know for sure.
Yeah. Dave Cronin, give him my regards.
Yeah, I'll be having lunch with him tomorrow. I'll do just that.
All right. That.
Okay, so we're you're appointed to the university committee now. Mm-hmm. The first year you are a member of the committee, and you get a sense as a faculty member. You of course saw that things were starting to get to heat up rather.
Well, let's go back a little just to paint the background. When I came to the university in 1947, there were 20,000 students on the Madison campus. By 1967, there were 31,000. I think you find that figure in the alumnus there. Mm-hmm. That's an enormous increase. The new buildings, new staff had to be added. But more than that, society was changing. And the need, I think that the need for changes was to meet this expansion was already evident when I came, because before the war, I think the figure would have been 12,000 for World War II. But things sort of came to a boil at the time of the, let me take that back. The situation, the pressure then was building up for some major changes in the structure of faculty government on the Madison campus, but also outside in the state as a whole. When I came to Madison, there was one University of Wisconsin, Madison campus. By 1967, I think there were 13. You can check that in there.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right.
13. And we now had a University of Wisconsin system. And we had no provision for faculty government. And of course, the consequence was the development of a university-wide system which would have a university faculty assembly. All right?
Mm-hmm.
And that, the corresponding, or the element corresponding to the Madison University Committee was the University Faculty Council.
Council, right.
All right?
Correct.
And I was elected to the first of those with Jim Villamont. Jim Villamont was to chair our Madison group, and I was on it, though, and a couple of others there in there. So already there were changes by 1967, but these were very peaceful changes, and they were handled by the University Committee for the Madison campus by what were standard procedures, study by committees, recommendations of committees to the University Committee, and then recommendations of the University Committee to the faculty. Then the faculty would have the final vote and decision. The importance of the University Committee stemmed from the fact, two things really, that there were men with experience on the campus already. And the second thing was that, as I learned very shortly after I joined the committee, the University Committee had access to an incredible amount of information about what was going on around the university. We could have available information on any activity, and we got it. And this meant that they had, if they used it properly, a factual basis for recommendations to the faculty that should be sound. And they should be influential, because if, with all that information available to them and experience with the university, if they could not make sound recommendations to the faculty, they should have been fired at once and replaced by another committee. I'm telling you what I told at a legislative hearing, which I was called to speak. The newspapers played up the role of the University Committee to a degree that was funny to us. They were always talking about the powerful University Committee, and after a while it wasn't such a joke, because it got into the newspapers, it got to the legislature, and I was called to appear before the Legislative Committee. And this gave me an opportunity to say, influential, yes. If we're not, fire us. I didn't say it in those words, but that was the gist of my testimony. Powerful? We have no power. The university faculty as a whole, when they meet, can and occasionally have turned down our recommendations. The power lies with the faculty, and that's where it belongs. I don't know whether they really believed me or not. I never got a reaction from it afterwards, but I hope they did, because that was the message that I had to convey. We were influential. Heaven help us if we weren't.
Was that the legislative committee that was formed after the Dow riots, the one that was chaired by the Lieutenant Governor
That's
Olson,
right.
I think his name, Jack Olson,
yeah.
Something like that?
I didn't see an account of that in here.
I found a count of it the other day, and I think that I thought that sounded like the committee that you were talking about the other day off mic that we couldn't figure
out. That was the one, yes. Yeah. Well, I took that hearing very seriously, because by that time, those of us on the committee realized that, I'm getting ahead of myself. Well, the trouble with Dow Chemical started in the winter of 66, 67.
Right.
The Dow Chemical came for a series of interviews, which were held over in the engineering buildings, and a protest against them arose because they were manufacturing napalm, which is being used in the Vietnam War. And I should recall at this point that dissatisfaction with the conduct of the Vietnam War had been increasing during this period, and was coming to a climax. So, those are the first disturbances in the spring. And there came then the demand that they be excluded from the campus entirely. Now, at this point, this became a serious issue. And the university took the next thing that developed were the riots themselves, which took place in October of 1967. These are the culmination of a rising protest movement on the campus.
And this was directed at the Dow in Commerce Building.
Yes. And this, the student protest movement on the campus was being encouraged, indeed fomented, by an organization called the Students for a Democratic Society.
SDS, yes.
Who picked as one of their targets the University of Wisconsin. Berkeley was another, Columbia was another, and there was one other. And they...
You said this became a very serious matter.
This became a very serious matter. And it culminated, of course, in the riots of October 19th. The chancellor at this point put out a statement given to the Wisconsin alumnus.
This is
an excellent statement, Dr.
Sewell.
of the university's position in a situation of this kind. Basically, what he pointed out was a simple premise that the university is an educational, not a political institution. That if it attempts to serve one political cause after another, it will destroy itself as an educational institution, because in such an institution there should be room for the expression of all points of view. We discussed this in a long meeting of the university committee, and we unanimously agreed that we should present to the faculty a motion supporting the chancellor's position, fully supporting it. And I presented that to the special faculty meeting, which was held on October 23rd.
Where was that held? Was that held in
the Union
Theater?
That was held over in Memorial Union.
The Union Theater. Was it a full house?
We had a full house.
Was it, can you describe, was it a charged, what was the atmosphere like in that meeting? Do you recall?
Well, I would say it was potentially explosive, except for one thing. After that, the initial riots, I stayed home, and my phone was ringing all afternoon and evening of that day, and I guess into the next day, from individual members of the faculty. And they only wanted to know one thing: how can we help? And I think because of that, we felt confident that we would have the support of the faculty. And as a matter of fact, the vote was about 2-1, according to the Wisconsin alumnus. Something like 647 or 87 to 361, you can get the figure out of that. We knew then that we were dealing with a vociferous minority. We subscribed on the committee unanimously to the principles that, individually, we subscribed to these principles unanimously. No question, you can't allow a campus to be run by protest groups and still have academic freedom. And academic freedom is what this university is all about, the right of everyone to express his or his own opinion, but not at the expense of the rights of others.
Let me interject right here, just for the record, people listening. The university committee at this point consisted of six people. Those were Charles Lohmer, John Ferry, Philip Cohen, Professor Cameron, David Johnson, and James Villamont. So that's a pretty distinguished group right there.
Good. Well, I'll just say I had a fine committee. There wasn't any question about it. And I would like to point out, in view of what has been happening in recent years, that the university would do well to remind itself of the basic principles that are involved in academic freedom. The vote, it was a, you asked if the meeting were tense. It was dynamite. But perhaps I should tell you one incident that diffused that.
Please do, please do.
At my elbow, we had had advice on this from James Cleary.
Mm-hmm. Vice Chancellor.
He was Vice President.
Vice President.
Who, expert on parliamentary procedure. This is almost his profession. I take that sentence back. Eliminate it. But an expert in parliamentary procedure.
He was a speech professor.
Professor of speech, I think.
Yeah, professor of speech, that's right.
And Jim advised the committee to set this up not as a meeting. We knew an emergency meeting and a motion had to be presented to the faculty. We decided that. But Jim recommended that the session not be a meeting of the university committee, ordinary meeting, but a meeting of the faculty, meeting as a university committee of the whole. And he said the reason for this is that in that situation, there's a greater flexibility in the rules, and you may want that flexibility to obtain during the session, instead of the narrow interpretations that would rule an ordinary meeting. Well, the meeting went along, and we had decided that we would call first on someone we knew that was for the motion, and someone alternate between that and
pro and con,
and what, anti, you see, someone that was against it. And this we tried to do, and after the meeting gone for one time, a certain amount of time, a certain professor got up to speak for the other side. I don't know that I need to name his name, do I?
If you care to, it doesn't...
Pardon?
If you care to name it, that's fine. I don't know. I don't... If you care not to, if you prefer
Well, all
not
right.
To,
it was a Professor Zeitlin.
Is that Murray?
Mm-hmm.
What's his first... Is that Murray's... Maury Zeitlin?
Yeah. Zeitlin.
Okay. Right.
An excellent speaker. A very forceful speaker. And he was bitterly opposed to the motion of the university committee. But it got to the point where he was so far out of order in his remarks that I, in ordinary terms, I asked him to step down from the podium, which he did, and at that point, Jim Cleary tugged my sleeve. And he said, Gene, I think you made a mistake. Remember, you're operating under the rules of a university committee, a committee of the faculty of the whole. Or rather, the faculty serving as a university committee of the whole. I think you must withdraw that order. And I guess an angel spoke in my ear, and I said, okay, Jim, and I called him back to the platform. What we got from the rest of his speech was a well-presented speech, but not a tirade.
Mm. So it diffused the situation somewhat.
Yeah. And the whole tone of the meeting changed. Because I think we simply realized at that point that we really meant it when he said that all sides are going to be heard. Mm-hmm. I shouldn't knock like that, should I?
It's okay. You'll wake someone up who's listening to it someday. That knocking will hit them in the ears. Go ahead.
Yeah. And when that was really it was realized and was accepted, but then the tone of the meeting completely changed.
Interesting.
And the vote, again, was overwhelming in favor of supporting Chancellor Sewell's motion.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was an important event in the history of the Madison campus, because it set the tone for future meetings at which difficult things had to be discussed. And anyone coming into that would know that all views would be entertained, and that it was up to them to decide, which they did. And well,
we talked about the concept of faculty governance. How did it hold up? Did it hold up through that Vietnam period pretty well? Or
I would say it held up very well, because we had a lot of people on our faculty who were devoted to the system. Mm-hmm. It held up very well. Now, we did have to, well, one of the changes that came out of this, actually, according to the record, it appears to have been underway before this crisis took place, is the replacement of the fully democratic procedure in which all the faculty involved at faculty meetings, they all could come and all could vote,
mm-hmm.
more or less like the New England townhouse town meeting. Everybody who was a member of the faculty could come and he could speak and he could vote. The problem was with that was that you knew that at each of these meetings only a minority of the faculty were really truly represented. Now, there was a strong debate over this because, well, I remember several members of the, well, no, I won't put it that way, skip that. I had spoken to members of the faculty who felt very strongly that we should continue with that system, because he said the people who really care about the Madison campus will come. And those who don't come just don't care enough to be interested in his problems. And they were very reluctant to see this fully democratic system replaced by representative government in which each department or division would be represented in some way by one or more
people.
There was a lot of opposition to it. And there was a merit in that argument. But the trouble is that when the town meeting gets to a certain size or the people represented grow to a certain number, it just becomes impossible to maintain the town meeting type of thing. And so the provision for a faculty senate was formulated and was passed, approved by the faculty, and that's what we have now.
Yeah, professor.
Each department is represented by a certain number of people who are appointed by the department or elected by the department and represent us at these meetings. So there you are.
I think Professor David Fellman had a... Pardon? Professor Fellman, David Fellman from Political Science, I think, had played a major role in the development mm-hmm. of the faculty senate.
Mm-hmm. No. And there were others too.
Mm-hmm.
At, so we felt as a university committee that we had to go along with this, and that was the faculty wanted. So I think others will have to tell you how well that's really worked.
Yeah.
There are a lot of, I won't say a lot, I won't put it that way, there are faculty members, or were at the time. My term is university committee member came to an end. There were and there may still be a number of faculty members who just can't be bothered just not interested in that kind of thing and just don't attend. And I don't know any way of overcoming that except pressure from the individual departments to have their people attend and represent them truly. But the opportunity is always there for them to do so. Mm-hmm. The opportunity is always there for their representatives not only to propose, to argue for, but to vote for the department. So we have the potential for full representation in it, even though that potential will be rarely realized. It's one of these choices that a large institution has to make. Now, well, let's see. I don't know. What else do you want to cover?
Okay. For those people listening, all of the references I gave to Professor Cameron, there's a copy of those in that I have, and they're in Professor Cameron's file in the Oral History Project, so please feel free to consult those. I just wanted to read in the fact that there were 51 regular and special meetings of the University Committee held between June 20th, 1967 and June 7th, 1968.
The number of
meetings and special meetings is just mind-boggling. The amount of time. Do you have any way of gauging how much time a week you were spending on this?
Well, I'll tell you, I carried full teaching load up to a point. I'm sure the students whose research I was supervising at that time must have felt they weren't getting as much time as they should, but they understood it. Mm-hmm. I would come in the morning, open the door and get last year's lecture out and give it. He started within the next 15 minutes. Now, I never did that before.
Yeah, right.
I always looked over my notes the night before and sometimes, or the morning before, and sometimes, if it were on my mind, I'd do this with the idea of revising certain things or adding, you see, just sort of bringing your things up to date, you know. I could never just give the same old lecture time after time. And one of the things that made my undergraduate course, that I'd call it undergraduate course, no. It was a university course. I had to make a special request to the department, to the divisional committee, to get approval to do this. But I said, look, this material is important to every citizen of the United States. And it doesn't matter in college whether he's a junior or a graduate student. I'll have them both in my courses. And I won't put any pressure on anybody. And they went along after considerable discussion. And that's the way it was. That course, you see, when I came to Wisconsin, the main man I was succeeding was Charles Kenneth Leith, one of the most famous of American economic geologists, and a man who was intensely interested in the mineral policy of the United States. I came out of the Strategic Minerals Program of the U.S. Geological Survey, which taught me what happens to a nation when it neglects its mineral problems. The amount of money we spent to get limited additions to supplies, which we had to have, was just appalling. Well, when I came to Madison, Leith was very busy with the War Production Board and so on, advisor to the president and so on. And he'd been busy ever since World War I. And he used to come home, his office was reserved for him. And he spent the summer here in Madison, kept his home out here. And a day or two after he came back from Washington, I received a call from him asking me to come up to his office. And I went in, and we shook hands. I'd never met him before. And we talked a few minutes, and then he started asking me questions. And I soon realized he took it for granted that my qualifications as a regular economic geologist studying mineral deposits would be checked by the department. He wanted to know one thing.
What's that?
Was I interested in the mineral policy of the United States, or was I not? Mm-hmm. I thought to myself at the time, this is wonderful, because I had made up my mind that I wanted to talk about that as part of my teaching program. Mm-hmm. And I told him that. He was delighted. He set up a scholarship and kept it for a few years till his death in support of a student, deserving student in the course.
Interesting.
And that's the one thing he wanted to know, because he'd been through the mill on this and gone through some harrowing situations in mineral supply in his work on the War of Munitions Board. They were so close to starving the program of mineral raw materials in some places that you wouldn't believe it. Well, they had people saving tin cans and that kind of thing, you know. And and later on, to my great satisfaction, I had the honor of escorting him for an honorary degree.
Here at UW?
Yes, I did.
Great. Yeah,
he is a great old man, I'll tell you.
Shakers and movers in the history of this place.
Yeah. But the minute he found out that I was genuinely interested in these problems, that settled it. And the notes for that one, I had to revise those every year in some years, drastically, for the lectures in that, simply because things were changing fast in mineral policy. Mm-hmm. Take the time of the Arab oil embargo, when we were nip and tuck whether we were going to have enough oil to get by, and other times. But, I won't get started on that.
I want to get back to the, let's leave that for a minute. I just want to ask a few more questions about the Vietnam thing. Within the Department of Geology itself, I'm talking about faculty and students, was there any serious division because of the war?
No.
Was that ever getting shouting matches or anything like that? The several departments were very very divided across.
I think the department. You're not going to quote me on this. Turn off your recorder.
Okay,
science people in the science.
In terms of we're back on again. In terms of the actual Dahl riots themselves. Did you witness it personally, or?
Oh yes.
Tell me what it was. Tell me what you remember.
Oh yes. Well, I'm afraid the details. I remember being in the classroom, and I was teaching minerals of public problems.
Oh,
as a matter of fact, and in the middle of a lecture, and the door opened, I had closed the door to the lecture room in Science Hall where I was, as I always did, and the door was wrenched open, and a young man stood there. He said, "How can you carry on your course when this is happening?" And I just slammed the door in his face. There wasn't a murmur from my students. They say, obviously, it was from a wild kid and they got overexcited, you know. Anyway, that's the way it was.
and you were in Science Hall, so you were right down there. You were not hidden somewhere.
Other time, I remember watching out my window. The police traded tear gas with rocks with the students. Went back and forth along Park Street. Between me and the union.
Mm-hmm.
My office is on the ground floor, overlooking Park Street and looking to the west over the lake, right at the corner of the building. So I had a full view of what was going on.
Mm.
and the students were throwing stones, and tear gas was the response.
Did the geology department ever sustain any damage from any of that?
No, we didn't. Our students were not aligned with these radicals. Of course, you're really talking about the big elementary courses where we do people from all over the campus. We had no trouble in those, not that I remember. You see, the people calling the shots in the student movement or active in it were a minority. And we knew that from a lot of things. The attendance in classes, for example, didn't fall off. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't a problem with that. And, but you asked my time, how my time was involved. Well, if I was lucky, I got by with a 16-hour day. Mm-hmm. All these special meetings and preparing for them and seeing people who had to be contacted, doing my own teaching, trying to take some kind of decent care of my students. But a lot of it is just a blur now. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't need time to take notes on all these meetings. But I had some... you're not recording this, are
you? This is recorded, yes. We have it on now.
Well, I think this is as far as I want to go.
Well, let me ask you one other question about, this is something I've never had a chance to ask anyone before, university committee member. I've talked to several people who were on the university committee when Ed Young and Irv Shane were the chancellors. And they talked about the fact that it was not unusual. As a matter of fact, it was common for Irv to come in and sit on at least part of the meeting every week. There was a real strong relationship between the chancellor and the...
Very close relationship.
What about with Professor Sewell, who had been on the committee the year before he became chancellor? What kind
I was in touch with him.
Did he come into the committee itself? Or
not often that I remember, but I kept him informed as to what we were doing. I'd have lunch with him over at the university club, and I'd talk about what we had been doing and the problems we were having, so that he was kept fully informed. Mm-hmm. I thought his statement, and I was glad to see it repeated there, I thought his statement was a fine statement that he made as to the university's response. It's an excellent statement. And I all I did in my presentation just indicate the university committee backed him up fully, and we did. We meant it. Wasn't any fooling around. But I was involved in so much every day that there's no chance that I could remember it all. Just going from one thing to another so fast. But this is just a personal opinion. Looking back over the 50 years, 51 years, 50, just a little over 50 years since I joined the faculty in 1947, in the fall of 1947. I must say that I am somewhat dismayed by over the reversal of the policy of academic freedom, which has taken place to some extent on this campus in the, last 10 years? Mm-hmm. The politically correct this, the politically correct that. I would not want that phrase even to be used on a university campus. the reversal, specific reversal of our decision and recommendation to the Regents, which they accepted, on that investment policy should not be influenced by politics. Our insistence with Sewell that the university is an educational institution, and that any breach of the principles of academic free speech and breach of academic freedom on the campus should be rebuffed. Any attempt to convert, as protest groups always want to, the Madison campus from an educational institution to a political institution should be turned down completely. And I don't mind being quoted on that, because I think this is the thing that troubles me most as I watch the events, have watched the events of the last 10 years. You cannot serve two masters in this, either one or the other, but not both. We have always had groups who are so immersed in their enthusiasm for a particular political cause that they forget that we have other institutions that other institutions that are political and should be used for those political purposes. All right.
There's one committee that you list on your CV that intrigues me, and that's that you served on the parking committee for the university. Anybody who knows the University of Wisconsin knows that parking has always been and probably will always be a real contentious area. Could you tell me about your service on that committee?
Yes, I can very readily. It was just a natural outgrowth of the tremendous growth of the campus. Mm-hmm. Not only in numbers of students, but in physical extent. I mean, just think, there was no wharf building at that time. Those buildings on the extreme west of campus weren't even there. Van Hise wasn't built. When was that built? Yes, it was there at that time. But that was true. There was our buildings going on, including Weeks Hall, in which I was involved. But the need for... Well, at that time, Madison was committed to walking. If you wanted to get someone from one end of the campus to the other, you had to walk. And you had to have enough time between periods so people could walk. That's where that 15-minute interval came from. I mean, suppose you were over in engineering and you wanted a course over at Science Hall. Well, you had time to get over there, see? And we had a lot of students from engineering. So, and there were people that were firmly committed to this, to an amusing extent. Well, at that point, and for reasons I'll never know, I was selected as chairman of the Parking and Transportation Committee. And we just took the bull by the horns and laid out what is now the present system of Walnut Street and the system of the need for ramps, parking ramps. The whole system was laid out by that committee, and we're still following it. Now, it's now bursting its seams due to that cold center.
Yeah, the new basketball center, yeah.
Well, I think you have an attitude there that's hard to break. That same day you saw that article, there were a couple of other articles. The university is going to add a women's hockey team. That means more votes for more parking for Cole Center. Cole Center is going to be the host of those games, of that team. The university has the money and the will to do that. What was the other one? Oh, it's also limited the parking privileges of the area surrounding Cole. Now, apparently they did warn people that that was coming, but even so, that's an indication of where the university puts its priorities. The staff and faculty in that surrounding area are just going to have to do without for a period of several weeks, because we have, what is it, three things now. You know, we have basketball tournaments, mm-hmm. and they all overcrowd the area. Mm-hmm. I didn't take a parking permit this year for the first year. First place, the price was too high, and I wasn't ill. I wasn't even sure I could use it, and that was a good decision. But I wouldn't pay that. To heck with it. But it means our priorities are not quite logical for a university when it comes to things like athletics versus science and the arts and so on.
How did you have any trouble getting that plan through in the parking committee? Did you get any resistance from people who were sort of anti-cars or?
Oh, we had some. I don't remember the details. I don't remember there's any particular fracas about it. So many people recognized that it was its time had come.
Yeah, maybe it was just that.
The timing was. Yeah. Absolutely perfect. There were disputes about individual areas. That area at the corner of Regent and Park, for example, was one. The where the old First National Bank used to be. But these were minor things, you know. No, for the most part, people gave in quite quickly, and were glad to have these things. And the setting up that. Walnut Street parking area. Yeah. I think that was one of our most important things.
That's lot 60, right?
Two reasons. Yeah. Tremendous expansion of parking. Second, reasonable rates for those members of the faculty and staff that couldn't afford the expensive places. So I think it served a twofold purpose. No, that went off all right. I don't remember any details now. And, I do remember we had a little tussle at when we presented that to the university committee, I think. But I don't remember.
What year was that?
Hmm?
About what year was that? Approximately.
That would be in the, I think the early 60s.
That sounds
is
funny.
It given in there?
No, it doesn't. I'm trying to think. Yeah, I think that would be right. I came here in 70 and it was firmly, it was well, it was going on.
Yeah,
it had been going on for
right.
a while. It also opened up that whole bus route. I lived in Eagle Heights. So
yeah,
I would
the
take
bus.
The bus from Eagle Heights to Lot 60.
The bus system was installed at that time,
yeah,
too.
Right.
That's
so,
right.
That really was a major change in the whole transportation.
I think it was a darn good job.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I can't imagine living in Eagle Heights without that bus service the way they had it set up.
Very important.
Let's go for a moment to your involvement with state and national geological organizations. You were a member of several of these organizations.
Yeah.
You know them a lot better than I do. Could you talk about the ones that you belong to that you're particularly, where your involvement was particularly?
The most important society for me has been the Society of Economic Geologists, for whom I prepared that. I chaired the committee that prepared that volume.
This is a 75 Years of Progress, 1920 to 1995,
yes.
called the Society of Economic Geologists, Inc.
It was formally constituted late in 1920, early 1921. by a group of professional economics geologists who within a year grew to 140. They started out as about a dozen. They felt the need for such a society because economic geology was broadening. The number of professionals in U.S. and Canada, where this started, was growing. They designed it to be a professional society, as opposed to the ordinary scientific society. These were all to be people, professionals. They were to subscribe to a code of ethics, professional ethics. Membership was open to anyone from the world. They would have to have at least 8 years' experience. This is not a society for beginners. Membership was open to anyone from any other country of the world having the proper qualifications, and was encouraged. At one time it tried to set up international branches, but that didn't work very well. It was too cumbersome. It's been a top-notch society for all those 75 years. And I was active as first as a member. I joined in the early 1940s. And then a secretary, and then a vice president and president, finally. And the other things are given in there.
Mm-hmm. Right, the book is
so
very interesting.
That's been that, and its foundation have been a major interest of mine for many years. I'm also a life member of the Geological Society of America. For a time, I maintained memberships in Geological Association of Canada and in the Geological Society of South Africa, but I dropped those when I retired and was no longer active in those areas. Mineralogical Society of America, I served on the council at one time and was quite active in that for some years, and I was a member of the American Geological Institute for some years. And have I left out any? I don't think so. That's about it.
Okay. Great. Whenever I give out my format to people, that's what I call the questionnaire, essentially, that we'll be working from. The last section I call last word. I like to give the person I'm interviewing the chance to have the last word in case they have anything they would like to say. Is there any last word that you would like to have, Professor Cameron, in this interview?
What I told you about academic freedom, and I'd like it to begin in this way. It is now almost exactly 50 years since I joined the University of Wisconsin at Madison in 1947. On a gray day like this, with a few snowflakes dripping down, I sensed it then as being a dynamic institution, and I liked what I found in the geology department, so I made the decision. I think the most important issue that I've had to deal with outside my own department since I came to Madison is the issue of academic freedom. And I just want to say this, and you can go on with what I said before.
I'd like to thank you very much for this.
Well, I'd like to say that I think as long as this university, I send it this way, conforms to the basic principles of academic freedom, I am confident that it will be the great university in the future, as it has been in the past. Well, you said, you know,